From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Hanan Ashrawi, one of the key figures in the Middle East peace process. She was spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation at the peace talks. She declined a position in the Palestinian Authority that now governs Jericho and the Gaza Strip. Instead, she founded a human rights group to serve as a watchdog over the new governing body. Also today, screenwriter Richard Price tells us about updating the 1947 film noir classic Kiss of Death. Price is also the author of the best-selling novel Clockers, and he wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, and Mad Dog and Glory. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Sue Miller's new novel, The Distinguished Guest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. 13 Cuban refugees have been returned to Cuba. The Coast Guard says one of its cutters returned the group of men to a Cuban naval station about 40 miles away from Havana. The men are the first Cubans repatriated under a new U.S. policy that's been denounced by Cuban Americans. Cuban refugees have been routinely admitted to the United States for the last 30 years and granted political asylum. The Senate has approved the nomination of John Deutsch as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The vote was 98-0. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Deutsch was plucked from his Pentagon post as deputy defense secretary to head the CIA. He is expected to institute a broad shakeup of the nation's intelligence gathering apparatus still reeling from the Aldrich Ames spy case. New York Democrat Patrick Moynihan urged his Senate colleagues to confirm Deutsch, saying he is the right person to lead the agency into a new era.
The cloak and dagger model is even more inappropriate to our new economic situation than it was to the successful prosecution of the Cold War that has just concluded.
During his confirmation hearings, Deutsch said he would put new people in several top jobs at the CIA, saying it's time to let a younger generation lead the agency. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Louisiana officials say much of the flooding has receded in New Orleans after a storm that poured as much as a foot and a half of rain on the city in little more than 6 hours. 5 people are dead. New Orleans is below sea level, so it has to be mechanically drained by giant pumps through a series of canals. Scores of flooded homes have been deserted. Congress has heard testimony about Title IX, the 1972 law banning discrimination of female athletes at federally funded schools. The hearing was called in response to concern that the law hurts male athletes and doesn't help women. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
For one day at least, lawmakers presided over the issue of Title IX rather than judges. A slew of court cases in recent years has created a new layer of acrimony about the law. The plaintiffs in those cases, female athletes suing their schools for lack of athletic opportunities, generally have won and forced the schools into Title IX compliance. This means creating more teams and more participation for women. But many male coaches say compliance has forced schools to cut men's programs in order to make room. The men, they say, are the new victims of discrimination. While this point was disputed, there was a general consensus that everyone in the hearing room believed in the importance of Title IX. The dispute now is over how the law is implemented. Lawmakers say they will need more time to study the new concerns before deciding how, if at all, the law should be adjusted. In Washington, I'm Tom Goldman.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 5 points at 4,389. Trading is heavy on volume of 350 million shares. This is NPR. There's been a disagreement over Medicare in the Senate Finance Committee. The committee chairman says the health insurance program for the elderly is in dire straits. Oregon Republican Bob Packwood says Medicare is bankrupt and will run $165 billion short of what's needed to pay hospital bills over the next decade. But Health Secretary Donna Shalala says lawmakers cannot destroy Medicare in order to save it. She's accusing Republicans of wanting to trim the program to pay for tax cuts for the rich. For the first time ever, the United Nations has decided to start busing Serbs out of Croatia. Samantha Power reports from Pakrac.
Hundreds of Serbs in newly captured western Slavonia spent the sweltering day queuing up to secure spots on UN trucks. The trucks, which will run all week, will carry Serb civilians and their possessions across the Stara Gradiška bridge into Bosnian Serb-held territory. Croatian attempts to persuade Serbs to remain in Croatia have been largely unsuccessful. The unarmed Serbs are convinced that the relative goodwill of today will not last. They fear that when journalists and peacekeepers leave, the heavily armed Croatian soldiers who now control the area will punish them. UN officials deny that they are facilitating ethnic cleansing. They say that since they cannot guarantee the safety of the Serb minority, they have an obligation to help civilians leave. For National Public Radio, I'm Samantha Power in Pakrac.
A city of 600,000 is under quarantine after more than 100 people have died from a mysterious illness in Zaire. A consultant to the World Health Organization says the deadly Ebola virus is responsible. Ebola kills nearly 90% of the people it infects. There is no vaccine or treatment. Federal agents have reportedly questioned the young son of a material witness in the Oklahoma bombing case. The Associated Press is quoting an unnamed source who says FBI agents talked to the 12-year-old son of Terry Nichols for 5 hours over the weekend. Nichols is being held in Kansas as a material witness. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Middle East peace process might never have gotten as far as it has without the work of Hanan Ashrawi. The Arab-American writer Edward Said described her as the creator and speaker of the new language of the Palestinians. In the minds of many Westerners, she replaced the image of the terrorist with the image of an intellectual in a tailored suit who could speak movingly about her people's history and use the language of diplomacy to discuss their future. Ashrawi is a former English professor at Birzeit University in the West Bank. She was a spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation at the peace talks. The secret peace talks in Oslo developed out of a meeting held at her house. Ashrawi has written a new memoir called This Side of Peace, A Personal Account. She now heads the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights, a group she founded. I asked her to tell us what it does.
Well, the commission actually is a system of accountability. It is a combination of ombudsman, the Scandinavian tradition of ombudsman, and the universal tradition of state controller, as well as part of the Arab Islamic tradition of the court of grievances, having recourse to an address to present grievances against the authority. So in some ways it's a watchdog. It is also one of the institutions of civil society in order to ensure the rule of law, to ensure that the laws are applied uniformly and justly, and that the legal system itself is just. And we also monitor the activities of the national authority and the PLO to ensure against the abuse of authority and misuse of public funds, and to safeguard basic rights and freedoms. So it's a very tall order.
Right. Now, I'm wondering why you chose to do this instead of choosing to join the Palestinian Authority. And Yasser Arafat urged you to join it. He really wanted you to become part of the authority.
Well, I guess it's a question of commitment, a question of principle, and a question of knowing where your priorities lie. I feel that building a state and the whole process and challenge of nation building has to focus on institutions of civil society, on translating these principles of democracy and accountability and human rights into actual working systems and structures, and to ensure that whatever system of government we have is firmly ingrained and rooted in these principles. And I felt that this would allow us to work outside the confines of just Gaza, Jericho, geographically, or the constraints of a very flawed agreement and a very difficult transitional period.
The Palestinian Authority has been holding closed trials of Islamic militants who were accused of acts of terrorism. You've, I believe, called for the disbanding of this particular court. How come?
Yes. Well, first of all, these are military courts. This is called the State Security Court, which certainly is based on very negative models, whether in the Arab world or elsewhere. And the legal system it follows is based on the British emergency regulations or the Egyptian military orders. And these, in many ways, or essentially, are violations of civil and human rights. The courts themselves, of course, violate the independence of the judiciary in the sense that the executive has the right to intervene. And, of course, it's a military court, and the judges are three military officers. And at the same time, the whole way in which the courts have been working, holding sessions at night in the wee hours of dawn or pre-dawn. Very quick trials without the accused knowing the nature of the charges or without having the chance to appoint a lawyer. And quite often, you know, summons go out to witnesses at all sorts of strange hours. So in many ways, they are not conducive to due process or a just implementation of the law. And we see them in many ways as catering to Israeli priorities and needs, rather than to Palestinian priorities and needs. And I don't think you should try Palestinians because Israel insists that you try them. You cannot start abusing people's rights in order to show that you can deliver to the Israelis the security of Israelis. I doubt whether the Israelis would at any point, you know, arrest Israelis massively in order to demonstrate to the Palestinians that they care about our security.
I know that when Yasser Arafat tries to crack down on terrorists, he is often perceived as being a pawn of Israel.
Yes, he's been accused by the opposition to have been reduced to the level of an instrument of Israeli security. Now, I think that's quite reductive, and I describe this as being very ironic, because the Israelis in 28 years could not maintain security under occupation, using the strongest army in the region and using the most brutal repressive measures. So I don't see how they can expect the Palestinian National Authority or President Arafat to deliver their security to them using the same means. So the question is, where do you get stability and security? Only from addressing the issues that cause instability and that instigate violence. And this process, ironically, has undermined the Palestinian leadership and has pitted it against its own people, so to speak, in many ways, because it is being asked to show that it can deliver, it can represent the Palestinian people by putting an end to acts of violence or acts of resistance. And at the same time, it is being asked by its own people, not just to safeguard their own rights, but not to prevent acts of resistance from areas that are still under occupation. You see, there's this whole myth that the occupation is finished, that the Palestinian question is solved, and that the peace process is producing results, or that we have peace. And unfortunately, this is not the case. Most of Palestinian land is still under occupation, so are most of the Palestinian people. And the Israeli practices are business as usual. I mean, there are still massive arrests. There are 6,000 Palestinians in prisons. The whole area of collective punitive measures is still practiced by the occupation, whether in terms of closure or curfews. And at the same time, they want the Palestinians to behave as though the occupation is a figment of our imagination. And that's not the case at all. We have to deal not with the peace process as a verbal exercise, but with a reality that has to be transformed in order to show that the peace process can actually change people's lives.
I know you were very unhappy with the speech that Arafat gave at the signing of the peace agreement on the White House lawn. What was your problem with what he said? What were you hoping for?
Well, I said we didn't recognize ourselves in it. I mean, it was like a regressive speech, a throwback to these cliches and slogans, to sort of dealing with abstract politics in very reductive terms. It lacked the intellectual vigor, it lacked the emotional candor, it lacked the human substance and honesty that, for example, characterized our Madrid speech. And at that point, I felt that we were being taken back to the politics of exclusion rather than inclusion, rather than creating common terms of reference and a shared language of humanity and shared perceptions. We were being excluded as the reductive people who use the stilted word and the empty slogan. And that, I found, was an insult to our humanity and to our collective history, as well as to our aspirations.
You probably thought it was a big missed opportunity also, huh?
Well, yes, in practical terms, it certainly was. I remember when I had written a draft of a speech and some of the people on the executive committee looked at it, they said, well, He's not a poet and he's not an intellectual, and this is poetry and an intellectual speech, so he has to talk politics. I said, if politics does not have poetry and creativity and does not have the human substance and the intellectual perception, then certainly it has lost its core. I mean, it has lost its legitimacy.
Was this a speech that you'd written for Arafat to give at the signing, or was that another speech you're referring to?
I had written a speech for Arafat to read in Washington.
What did you say?
I tried to recall the collective history of the Palestinians as well as the cumulative struggle of the Palestinians, and to bring together the two wounded parts, you know, the Palestinians in exile, life in refugee camps, as well as the Palestinians under occupation. And this dual pain, I felt, had to be reconciled and presented as a unified vision, and to place ourselves in the midst of humanity, in the midst of human perceptions, that we have taken the decision to forge ahead, to move forward, to unite these components, and at the same time to reach out, not just to the Israelis or to the adversaries, but to each other and to ourselves and to humanity as a whole. And I also tried to find the common grounds, spiritual grounds, existential grounds, even religious grounds, in Christian, Muslim, and Jewish terms, in order to articulate this common message, and that in this process there should be no winner or loser, that peace should be triumphant for everybody, because that's the only way we can save our common humanity.
So what are some of the things that went through your mind during the signing of a peace of the peace agreement? Things that, of course, you'd be willing to share with us.
Well, yes, I described part of it in the book, and in some ways I described this process as another minefield. I said the easy part is over, now begins the difficult part. We had wrenched the course of history in order to legitimize the language of reconciliation and to create the attitude of courage that deals with peacemaking not as an act of capitulation, but as an act of will, and a triumphant will at that, for everybody involved. So I was sitting there listening to this reductive speech and at the same time listening to the Israelis speak. My friend Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, told me Rabin gave our speech. He usurped our history. And we should have given that speech. And I felt that there is an injustice there. But at the same time, I also knew that the tasks ahead were much more difficult. I knew that this was a very precarious peace, that the agreement is flawed, that it's going to take everything we've got in order to be able to translate it into a living reality. I knew that we had embarked on this unique process, I called it, of signing first and negotiating later. And we needed to negotiate the details, the steps of implementation, the concrete aspects of this agreement in ways that would not contain self-destruct mechanisms or seeds of future conflict.
My guest is Hanan Ashrawi. She was spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Now she heads the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Hanan Ashrawi is my guest. She's written a memoir called This Side of Peace. I'd be interested in hearing what I would imagine would be pretty complicated feelings about Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, the more extremist Islamic Resistance Movement. On the one hand, on some level, I'm sure you share some of its beliefs for, you know, in independence and a Palestinian state. On the other hand, I can only assume you don't share its tactics of getting that through acts of terrorism. Also, if the Islamic Resistance Movement took over Palestine, what room would that leave for you as a woman and as a Christian?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I think, a very central question, because we have been subject to this simplistic type of polarization. People perceive us either as being with the authority, with all its sins forgiven, regardless of ineptitude or corruption or whatever, or the only alternative being Hamas. And I kept saying, no, we have a whole spectrum of political opinion and political organizations that are basically and essentially democratic and humanistic, and that are neither one of these two options. And that's what we have to encourage. Now, Hamas, as far as I'm concerned, is part of this political pluralism. And on the whole, Hamas is a political movement. It does have a military wing. And of course, I disagree with any kind, not only disagree, I mean, I'm totally appalled by any act of violence against any individual, by anybody. And therefore, I feel it's neither justified nor legitimate nor acceptable in any way to carry out any kinds of violence against civilians and to target innocent victims in order to make a political point, be they Palestinian or be they Israeli. So these tactics, as you said, yes, I disagree with and I totally denounce. But at the same time, I feel that the way in which to deal with Hamas is to create the mechanisms of democratic involvement, to have an inclusive, participatory democratic system, particularly through elections, to protect Hamas's right to differ. And we said this in the Madrid speech. We said we have an opposition and we will defend the right to oppose and to differ all the time, provided they use legitimate political democratic means. So we have to create those means, those channels, those structures, to include the whole political spectrum, because any exclusion is an invitation to violence.
I think a dilemma a lot of people face in situations like this is if, you know, you fight democratically, but if this other group, you know, the fundamentalist group comes into power, then democracy is closed down, because fundamentalist-run societies tend to not be pluralistic societies.
Yeah, but you can't be selective about democracy and say, I will apply it only when the results suit me, and if the results don't suit me, then I will negate the democratic process, which is what happened in Algiers, for example. I don't believe that you can distort your own society in order to cater to your own needs, or to say, I'm going to protect democracy by being undemocratic, or I'm going to stifle others in order to protect my freedom of expression and speech. No, I think you have to create the conditions so that the voice that wins is the voice of reason.
Hanan Ashrawi is my guest, and she's written a memoir called This Side of Peace. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your life. You were born in the last part of the period when Palestine was a British mandate. Tell us a little bit about where you lived and what your family was like then.
Well, actually, when I was born, it was the beginning of the end for Palestine, because in 1947, as you know, I was born in the end of 1946. In 1947, the UN Resolution 181 created the what we call the two-state solution, but only half of it was implemented, and the State of Israel was created, and Palestine disappeared, so to speak. So in many ways, the basic factors that influenced my life took place either just after I was born or before I had any sense of awareness of what was happening. My father was a doctor in the Palestine army, so he was moving from one city to another in Palestine, and as I said, having a daughter in every place, in every town they lived in. I was number five among five daughters, and strangely enough, I wasn't born in Ramallah itself. I was born in Nablus, and my parents immediately moved to Tiberias. So when the 1948 war took place, they were in Tiberias, and I was a baby. And they had to be smuggled out of Tiberias. I described it in my book by a Jewish doctor friend of his, Dr. Efrati, actually, who helped them escape Tiberias, and they went to Jordan, to Amman, Jordan. My father came back to Palestine and helped for a while there, before finally the whole family went back to Ramallah, which is the ancestral homeland of my father, the town where he comes from. And that's where I grew up all along.
You said that your father believed in equality for women. How did he let you know that when you were a girl?
Oh, from the beginning. It's not just a question of words or ideology. Actually, he didn't have many words. He was economical at the verbal level. But in the way he treated us, in the way he brought us up, in the way he would not allow any kind of social intrusion in our lives to define the parameters or limits of our own endeavor as women. He kept saying, you can do whatever you want to do as a human being, and don't accept any imposed limits on you. And for example, he took it for granted that we would all go to universities, we would all be educated people, that we will all work as his daughters. He took it for granted that they would not in any way interfere in our basic life decisions, whether marriage or education or career, that they would raise us to have the confidence and ability to forge ahead. And I remember he always had this statement that was a favorite of ours, saying you have to be, in the pursuit of what is right, you have to be strong.
You thank your family in your memoir for loaning you to the peace process. How do you think your family changed to manage things in your absence? I think your husband is an artist and musician. Is he home a lot? Did he take care of the kids a lot while you were gone?
Yes, certainly. He said it gave him the chance to enjoy fatherhood. I remember in one interview he was asked if he was... He said he spends most of his time with the girls, with our daughters, and at home, and the garden, and so on. And one woman interviewer told him, well, we call that a house husband. And he said, no, I call that being a father. and he has always lamented the fact that men have not really had the opportunity to fully enjoy the experience of fatherhood or parenthood in ways that women traditionally, could. And he felt that it was unfair and there had to be a real sharing. But in our case, a conscious decision had to be taken by us, by the nuclear family, for Emil, for my husband, to take over many of the tasks that normally would be shared by both of us, and to try to fill in for me in my absence and my just incredible and incredibly difficult schedule and tasks. And we evolved a very open and frank and warm relationship with the daughters, where we discussed everything beforehand and we took decisions collectively. And they knew that I'm there for them whenever they needed me, but they also knew that I was doing something much larger than my immediate presence. As my daughter Zena said, we lent my mother to peace so that she can go out and make peace and spend more time with us.
Hanana Shrawi, she's written a new memoir called This Side of Peace. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Kiss of Death. We talk with screenwriter Richard Price about updating the 1947 film noir classic. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin says that Price creates a full-blown universe of tangled motives, inexorable pressures, attention-getting backdrops, and small roles that make big impressions. Price also wrote the best-selling novel, Clockers, about cops and teenage drug dealers. Spike Lee is directing the film adaptation. Also today, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Distinguished Guest, by Sue Miller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The president of the nation's largest unions told a Washington audience he'll run for re-election. AFL-CIO Chief Lane Kirkland has had the job for 16 years, but some union members think it's time for him to go. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
Lane Kirkland says if nominated, he will stand, and if elected, he will serve. The announcement ends speculation that Kirkland might step down, but he is likely to face opposition in the October AFL-CIO elections. Kirkland's critics say at age 73, he lacks the energy and creativity critical to revitalizing organized labor. 11 member unions of the AFL-CIO have mounted an opposition campaign to his candidacy, although they haven't yet offered any candidates of their own. In a statement, the 11 groups said they will not support Kirkland because new, bold, and effective leadership is needed. The dissident group includes some powerful members of the AFL-CIO, including the United Mine Workers, the United Auto Workers, and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
A fierce storm in southeastern Louisiana is being blamed for 5 deaths. Officials in New Orleans say 4 of the victims drowned after the storm poured as much as 18 inches of rain last night. Roads into the city have been closed and scores of people have been forced to flee their homes. Michelle Moore is the spokeswoman for the city of New Orleans.
Right now, the rain has subsided, but we do anticipate another thunderstorm coming through with an anticipated 3 to 4 inches of rain between 1 and 5 p.m. this afternoon. And so, again, we're trying rescue efforts as we go through. There's some areas in the city that are dry, and then there are other areas that are significantly flooded. New Orleans is like a bowl to some respects in its geographical layout, and so there are areas that still have lots of flooding, and we're trying to make sure that those pumping stations remain open and continue to pump the water out as we can.
New Orleans is below sea level, so excess water must be pumped out of the city by a drainage and pumping system. Some flights have been diverted from New Orleans International Airport because up to a foot of water was standing on runways. Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards has declared a state of emergency for the entire New Orleans region. A published report says federal investigators are tracking a possible money trail in the Oklahoma City bombing. The Detroit News says investigators have subpoenaed the bank records of James Nichols. The Michigan man is a friend of bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh. The report says records show Nichols took about $5,000 out of his account before the bombing. The paper says that authorities want to know if any of that money passed to McVeigh. A spokesman with the Organic Growers of Michigan says a large cash withdrawal isn't unusual this time of year for organic farmers like Nichols. On Wall Street, stock market closed at yet another record high. The Dow gained 6 points to close at 4390. This is NPR. The Coast Guard says a group of Cuban rafters picked up last week in the Caribbean has been returned to Cuba. Cuban authorities have taken custody of the men. The Cubans were denied entry to the United States based on a new policy established by the Clinton administration. The White House has decided to admit all Cuban refugees housed at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. The Italian military has been called out to deal with increasing numbers of illegal immigrants who have been entering the country by boat from Albania. Regina Sansaloni reports from Rome.
For the first time since World War II, the Italian government has decided to deploy its armed forces in an effort to impede clandestine immigration. 500 soldiers will begin arriving tomorrow in Puglia, the region which forms the heel of the boot. Because Puglia is as close as 40 miles from the coast of Albania, it serves as a frequent gateway for illegal immigrants coming into Italy. Many then travel up the peninsula into Central and Northern Europe. Tens of thousands of Albanians have attempted the trip since 1991. In recent months, hundreds of Kurds, Pakistani, and Chinese have also made the crossing from Albania. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Santoloni in Rome.
President Clinton is in Moscow observing the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe. He spoke to Russians today about the shared goals that they and Americans have. Mr. Clinton says both countries can work together against war and terrorism. The president chose to stay away from a Russian military celebration. He is displeased with Russia's military assault in the separatist region of Chechnya. Alabama's renewed use of chain gangs is facing a legal test. An inmate has filed suit against the practice. Michael Austin says he was transferred from another prison to the Limestone Correctional Facility so he could serve on a chain gang. His suit says the work violates the constitutional right of due process and the protection against rather cruel and unusual punishment. He says because inmates aren't paid for the work, the practice violates the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Screenwriter Richard Price has updated the 1947 film noir, Kiss of Death. He kept the title, but changed much of the story. His film stars David Caruso as an ex-con who's lured back into a ring of car thieves run by a very crazy Nicolas Cage. Caruso is caught, but the cops offer to let him off if he helps them penetrate the operation. Caruso has to report to a cop, played by Samuel Jackson, who was shot in the face during the bust. Jackson has made Caruso wear a wire. In this scene, Caruso is passing on information to Jackson after a rough night with the car thieves.
These are the cars we took.
Where'd they go? Terminator body parts? Got anything else?
Yeah, there was a guy from the DMV there, but I couldn't get his name.
Yeah, we on to him. So you hook up with Junior?
Oh, yeah.
Man, how about Omar? Cut in Omar?
In two. Bought everything on the sheet, big bag of nines, going for a dozen max over the weekend.
All right. So I'll get that wire.
I threw it away.
What?
I threw it away. I got patted down twice tonight.
All right, so you're all right with him? That'll make it easier.
Easier for what?
Easier to wear a wire.
Let me ask you a question. Why you? You know, why did they put you on me? Revenge?
You see this eye here? Runs all the time. I can't make it stop. I got a third of my hearing in this ear. And when I want to go to the beach, direct sun gives me a migraine so bad I cry like a baby. So I asked for you. And if you take that wire off one more time, I'm personally going to beat you to death.
Richard Price is no stranger to the worlds of cops and crime. He also wrote the best-selling novel Clockers about cops and teenage drug dealers. Spike Lee's film adaptation is scheduled to open in September. Price also wrote the screenplays for Sea of Love, The Color of Money, and Mad Dog and Glory, which co-starred David Caruso. I asked Richard Price why he wanted to remake Kiss of Death.
It just had, you know, such an off-the-wall villain. The problem is that, you know, the villain, Richard Widmark, Tommy Udo in the original, was about as close to a sacred monster as you can get in those B-movies. So he's the thing that attracted me, yet he was the character that I better not go near. The other thing that was interesting to me was the dilemma of the sap in the middle, Victor Mature, who was squeezed between the amorality or the ambitiousness of the forces of law and order and the bad guys. And for that time period, 1947, I don't think I had ever seen a movie that was that cynical about good versus evil. And I thought that was very appropriate now, or could be busted open, you know, to set the tale now.
The racket that you built Kiss of Death around is a car theft ring. Why did you go with that?
Well, first I thought about doing drugs and
And then you said, did that.
Well, not did that. I mean, I ran into Nick Pileggi, and I had mentioned that I was going to be doing something, you know, using the arena of drugs. And he said, oh, what are you doing that for? At this point, I don't care how well it's written. At best, it's a TV movie. And it was his suggestion, why don't you do cars? I mean, cars make as much money for organized crime as drugs do, if not more. And then I hooked up with a police connection, a guy who was in the auto squad in Newark, which is the car stealing capital of the world. you know, I went to my local car mechanic, you know, who's quote-unquote interesting character, and I hooked up with one of Nick Pileggi's resource people, quote-unquote. You know, and I just did a little field work and I learned a little bit about the mechanics. The whole point of mastering the mechanics of something as arcane as stolen car business, how does it work, is just to know enough so you don't feel like a fool when you start making things up. You know, the parameters of reality in which you're making up lies. So it's like responsible lying.
You know, my heart sank watching the movie because the car thieves in the film would go up to a car equipped with a pricey alarm and just, you know, deal with the alarm and get the car in 2 seconds.
I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, basically all I know about cars is D stands for drive, R stands for reverse, you know, an 89 Toyota. You know, I'm not into cars. You know, but what I learned is that if they want a car, they're going to get it. The end.
Richard Price is my guest. He wrote the screenplay for the new film Kiss of Death. He also wrote Clockers. David Caruso has gotten really good reviews in Kiss of Death, and I think Kiss of Death was a real kind of testing ground for him in the movies because he left NYPD Blue. And
well, there's a second. It's funny because on one hand, there were two objects of attention which were competing with each other. One is the movie. Is it good? Is it bad? Two, does David Caruso have feet of clay, or is he going to be a superstar? Was he right, or was he wrong?
Exactly.
You know, so it seemed like it was almost like a second layer of reviews.
Right.
The movie got a review, and David Caruso's choice to be a movie actor over a TV star got a review.
Exactly.
And I got to tell you, most of the reviews I read were very positive and endorsing, you know, of you know, his potential as a star, and then you'd get all these other reviews saying, I didn't like the movie. David Caruso's a jerk. He never should have left TV. Well, why didn't you like the movie? Because he never should have left NYPD Blue. You know, I mean, I hope the guy just goes through the roof myself. But it was really interesting. It was almost like a lot of people just weren't even reviewing the movie. The movie was just this vehicle, you know, for the real object to be reviewed.
So this is his first movie. Kiss of Death is his first movie since NYPD Blue. Did you call him up as soon as he left and ask him to do it?
No, I didn't. No, you know what it is? It's this, the casting in a studio film is funny. It's like there are two big circles, and one circle is the movie stars that a studio will do anything with, no matter how appropriate or inappropriate. If you're doing a movie about an elderly black gentleman, and Tom Cruise wants to do it, Tom Cruise will do it. They'll put him in blackface. Or they'll change the character to a young white gentleman. You know, it's like they'll do anything to get the stars that they want. Everything is secondary to that. So they had a list of stars that they were interested in. Barbé and I had a list of people that we thought could really pull this off. And there's this very little tiny shaded area where the two circles intersected. We're about two or three actors. So, you know, Caruso was one of those very few choices that the studio liked and we liked.
My guest is Richard Price. He wrote the screenplay for Kiss of Death, and he wrote the best-selling novel, Clockers. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. I remember with your previous film, Mad Dog and Glory, there were test screenings, and I think the studio asked you to change the ending. And
yeah, they asked me to change the ending. They asked me to, you know, take my head off and replace it with something else.
Did you have test screenings for Kiss of Death?
Yeah. Apparently, you know, that's the way they do things now. There's so much money involved in the release of a movie. It's an average $25 million budget. And then you got to double that to advertise and release and rent theater rentals. And they're not going to put out a $40, $50 million investment out there without any market research.
So what effect did the test screenings have on the final shape of the film?
Well, not too much, I don't think. Sometimes they can tell you things that you need to know. Like, we're not getting it. we don't understand what's going on here. And sometimes, because you're so deep inside the story, you think that everything in your head made it to the page, and often it didn't. And they're telling you that. There's a sense of incoherence about the narrative. Sometimes they'll tell you that stuff, and you got to hear that. The problem with Kiss of Death for a lot of people, somebody said, well, we're not sure who the bad guys are and who the good guys are. Well, that's the point of the story. That's the whole source of attraction for me, was this guy had nobody to rely on, that, you know, the ambition of the good guys was equal to the ambition of the bad guys. But people like very clear lines, who's bad and who's good.
So what did you do with that feedback?
Me, nothing.
Did the studio ask you to do anything?
Oh, probably. You know, they sort of drown you in memos. The ending, well, I'll tell you one thing, that even before the movie was made, they said the ending had to be changed. So, you know, the hero sort of won the day in a very spectacular and single-handed way, bring down the mob, you know. And they, because my original ending was probably too passive, which is that Nicolas Cage was going to kill Jimmy, the David Crusoe character. And before he did it, he in turn was assassinated by his own people because he was too crazy and he had gone too far. And that was the original ending that I had. And they just felt like, no, we're following this guy. No way you can have him, like, luck out, quote-unquote, on the end. He's got to take destiny in his hands. He's got to do something big.
So your attitude has to be, okay, yes?
Well, you know, it's a hard trick because if they don't want you to do that, you're not going to do that. It's their dime.
Mm-hmm.
However, you don't have to do what they say, and hopefully you can come up with something that's a compromise that they can live with and you can live with. You know, otherwise things can get kind of despairing and silly.
Richard Price is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for Kiss of Death, and he also wrote Clockers, which is being made into a film. Is there a difference between writing dialogue for screen and for a novel?
Absolutely. I don't care how great the novel writer or how dazzling the dialogue on the page. If you try to put the dialogue words of a novel in an actor's mouth and have 2-3 actors play out that scene that anybody, exquisite writers, Don DeLillo, anybody, Robert Stone, it's going to sound written because it is written. It's amazing how much stuff looks dazzlingly authentic and true and beautiful on the page, but it dies in somebody's mouth. It sounds like creative writing. And this is a lesson that you have to learn over and over again, that the spoken word has nothing to do with the written word. It's so easy for something to sound, quote-unquote, written in somebody's mouth. And it's amazing how little is too much. I mean, I've heard De Niro reading some of my stuff in Mad Dog and Glory, and it sounded like, who do you think you are, anyhow? And it's not his fault. He was just, some metaphor I put in there, some simile, and it just sounded written, and it's so obvious.
Can you think of an example of something that you wrote that didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, well, this thing with De Niro, he was doing a scene in Mad Dog and Glory where he was explaining to Uma Thurman how he likes to, in the middle of the night, come down to the deserted section of Chicago and just take photographs, and how at one time he was down there and right in front of this big office building was a deer, and he had no idea how it got there, whether it broke out of the zoo, swam over from Indiana. And his one line, he said, a deer, you know, it had antlers like a chandelier. And the minute he said that antlers like a chandelier, you would never notice that on the page. It seems like a nice image. It's so obvious. What happens, that's the importance of a read-through for the writer and the director, because when the actors at a big round table read all the parts of a script, what doesn't work is going to pop up so obviously, and there's no substitute for that. There's no other way you can learn that except to hear it in somebody's mouth.
You told Neil Gabler in an interview that you're fascinated by the way people construct a sequence of words, the misnomers, the malapropisms, and how that reveals how they process the world. You say it's an oral Rorschach test. I think that's really interesting, and I think you do that really well in your dialogue, but I was wondering if you could come up with an example of that, of how you use malaprops or misnomers.
I've heard or read people saying stuff, stuff like, I remember I was at a crime scene in Jersey City, and I was with a cop who was working the crowd trying to find out if anybody knew anything. And, you know, he asked one kid, see what happened? He says, well, that boy got shot up. He said, well, do you know who did it? He says, well, I don't want to cast out no aspersions per se. another guy, came up in somebody else's thing. I guess what they meant to say, they were simonizing their car. If I can't remember where I read this, where the guy says, no, I didn't see anything, man. I was busy sodomizing my car. keep my ear to the grindstone. Money's no expense. The things that, but it's not just the humorous things, when you're out there, it's not so much what you're going to hear as it is everything that you're going to take in.
Without mentioning names, I feel like I've read novelists who've then done a lot of work in television, and it's had a bad effect on their dialogue in their novels. You know how you're saying there's a difference between how you write for the page and how you write for the screen. Do you ever worry that writing for the screen is going to hurt how you write for a novel?
No. Well, it's going to, not the dialogue, it's going to hurt, you have to unlearn a lot of things if you're a novelist in order to successfully write a screenplay, because all the instincts that a writer has to make a novel have a certain heft and seriousness and a certain depth all has to be exercised, because none of that stuff is relevant to a screenplay. A screenplay is about momentum. A screenplay is about that flat surface of the screen. It's who said what, who did what, and move. Whereas a novel is about, you dally in the valley. It's about language. It's about texture. It's about memory. It's about innuendo. You can spend, 10 pages, just delving into somebody's memories. And you cannot do that in a screenplay, so you have to unlearn all that stuff. It's like writing a novel is you're a marathon runner. Writing a screenplay, you're doing the 100-yard dash, and you can't have the pace of a marathon runner for a 100-yard dash. You have to really recoach your muscles, and then when you go back, you gotta relearn what you unlearned. It doesn't seem to be affecting me. I was worried about it before I wrote Clockers, but now I know I can go back and forth.
Richard Price wrote the screenplay for A Kiss of Death. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from NPR's Anne Garrels in Moscow about the final day of commemorations of VE Day. President Clinton is in Moscow, where he's going to be meeting with Russian President Boris Yeltsin for summit conference. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about an epidemic in Zaire, which is thought to be caused by the Ebola virus. That's killed a great many people and has resulted in a huge quarantine there. We'll be hearing from science reporter Laurie Garrett about that, and from Howard Berkus about the counties movement, a kind of a rebellion against not only federal government but state government too.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic Maureen Carrigan suspects that some marketing strategist who didn't read Sue Miller's new novel very closely probably thought it would be a shrewd idea for it to appear in bookstores in time for Mother's Day. After all, the distinguished guest, like Miller's 1986 breakthrough novel, The Good Mother, chronicles a turbulent relationship between a mother and child. But Maureen says that's where the similarities end.
If Anna Dunlap of The Good Mother was the embodiment of the mother as martyr, Lily Maynard of The Distinguished Guest is the archetypal withholding witch. She's in a class with Scarlett O'Hara and Joan Crawford when it comes to maternal bonding instincts. The Distinguished Guest would make a wonderful Mother's Day gift for those adult children seeking an elegant literary form of revenge. When the novel opens, Chilly Lily is about to arrive for an extended visit at the home of her middle-aged son, Alan, who's an architect, and his French wife, Gabby. This visit would be a trial under any circumstances. Lily is in her 80s now, and she's stricken with Parkinson's disease, which makes conversation between her and Alan even more difficult. But their relationship is further strained by the fact that Lily has become a Grandma Moses-type phenom. A few years earlier, she published her autobiography, entitled The Integrationist. Miller quotes passages from it throughout the novel. In her memoir, Lily described how she and her ex-husband were torn apart by the politics of the 60s. Her ex-husband, who was the minister of a mostly black church on Chicago's South Side, came to support the Black Power movement and the tactics of radical community organizer Saul Alinsky. In contrast, Lily's faith in peaceful protest never wavered. Critics hailed Lily's memoir as the saga of a woman finding herself. For Alan, however, Lily's success carries the sting of betrayal. He remembers only the pain of his parents breaking apart, a process Lily has depicted as her own slow feminist triumph. If Miller were a political novelist, in the popular mold of, say, Marge Piercy, we'd hear a lot more about Lily's 60s struggles. But Miller is more of a miniaturist. Miller uses the sensuous surface of things to convey ideas and emotions. Alan and Gabby's meticulously designed house, for instance, comes to represent the conscious effort that holds their marriage together. Miller gives most of her novel over to Alan, and through him, we experience the resentments of a grown child now compelled to care for a dependent, demanding parent. We also sense the sharp yearning to be close to his mother that he's never managed to quell. After Lily's death, Alan finds an old purse of hers, and Miller tells us, Alan feels that Lily has somehow just forgotten this, that he needs to find a way to get it to her, as though she were a traveler who had left something necessary behind. The Distinguished Guest is not a flawless performance. Its climax is overwrought, and Lily, despite her first-person commentary, remains a cipher. But Miller exquisitely chronicles the little deaths of estrangements and illnesses, which allow adult children like Alan to taste grief in manageable doses before the terrible final transformation of a parent into memory.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Distinguished Guest by Sue Miller. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.